Some say the world is a global village, where every human being is connected through a shared history and destiny. 510 million square kilometers of earth mass and 326 million cubic miles of water. But nowhere is there a spot for a person like him or like her. More than 100 million people are currently displaced from their homes. One in three is in Africa. No one abandons their home unless forced to. No one runs for a border unless his whole city is running with him. No one carries the anthem of his homeland under his breath to a foreign country unless he is a refugee.
Hello and welcome to this week's African Now show. We're coming to you from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, which serves as the central hub for refugees fleeing from Central African countries. Kenya hosts some of the world's largest numbers of refugees and has some of the world's largest refugee camps. In this week's show, we explore the growing number of refugees on the continent. At the moment, there are some 30 million refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced people in Africa. We ask the question, why have these numbers come about, and who is to blame? We posed our first difficult questions to the UNHCR. Adam Abdulmulla from the United Nations Assistance Mission in Somalia, thank you for joining us. Why does the Horn of Africa have the most number of refugees?
Well, it is one of the most affected regions of the world by climate change. Also, the region has some of the longest lingering armed insurrections, whether you look at Somalia or Ethiopia, you will see that there are armed groups that are waging wars against their governments. So that also contributes to the instability that leads to refugee outflows.
And why are so many refugees from Somalia?
Well, there are two drivers of population movements, whether inside the country or to the outside. And those are conflict, and Somalia has seen more than its fair share of conflicts since the collapse of the central government in 1991. And as we speak, there is a war going on here, the government fighting against the Al-Shabaab insurrectionists. And add to this, the main factor, the major factor for population movement across the Horn of Africa is climate change. But broadly speaking, if you look at the belt from the Indian Ocean to the Sahel in West Africa, this is the region that is most affected by climate change in the entire globe. And that's why you see that it is also the most affected region in the world by conflicts.
How many Somali refugees are there in other countries, and how many internally displaced people are there in your country?
Well, I don't have an exact number of refugees outside Somalia, because the refugee outflows started since the early 1990s, since 1991 to be exact. So it is hard to give you an exact figure of how many Somalis are actually refugees in other countries. Some people go as far as 5 million Somalis who live in other countries. As to the internally displaced, the number that we have is 3.8 million people. Some of them displaced most recently, and some of them have been in displaced camps for extended periods of time.
What can be done to deal with the situation?
Two things need to be done concurrently. One is to provide as much assistance as possible to save as many lives as possible. We estimate that this year, 2023, 8.23 million Somalis, and that is almost half of the population, will need some form of humanitarian assistance. And of those, we anticipate that 513,000 children will be severely, acutely malnourished between April and June this year. Therefore, we have to scale up our humanitarian response to save as many lives as we can. But given the fact that this is a climate-induced crisis, we also need simultaneously to invest more in climate adaptation and water management and water conservation and those kind of interventions require development investments that would enable the country to adapt to this rapidly intensifying and accelerating climate change.
What sort of help does the United Nations need in order to be able to continue to help the affected communities?
We need two types of help. We need assistance that would allow us to save lives, and that is mainly in four key sectors: health, nutrition, food security, and water and sanitation. Those are the key areas. Of course, there are other areas as well, such as protection and so on. That's on the one side. That's on the life-saving side. But the UN also works on development in accordance with the national plans. So the way it works is that there is a national development plan, and then there is a cooperation framework between the government and the United Nations. And the cooperation framework is mainly to enable us to support the government's development initiatives. And while we see that there is some relative focus on the humanitarian relief component, we see less investment being done by the donor community on the development side. And we just think that to break this cycle of endless humanitarian crisis, we need to match the humanitarian interventions with development interventions.
Do you see an end to the crisis?
Do I see an end to the crisis? Well, the end will only come if resilience is built, if Somalia is enabled to be stronger, build the infrastructure, do the climate adaptation, and develop. Natural disasters hit many countries in the world, but Somalia's fragility leads to these catastrophic situations where you have enormous numbers of people in need of humanitarian assistance. So this is unsustainable, and that's why the only way to end it is to invest more in the development of the country.
In northeastern Kenya, in a semi-arid district, the Dadaab refugee complex is the world's largest refugee camp. It's made up of three refugee camps and dates back some 30 years. The first refugees arrived in 1991, escaping war in neighboring Somalia. The next big influx was 20 years later, as Somalis sought refuge again in this camp from hunger and starvation. Today, as many as a quarter of a million people live in the Dadaab refugee complex, from where our next report comes. It's now 3 days that we've been waiting for a flight to Dadaab, and again, the airport is closed. Ever since William Ruto was elected president of Kenya a few months ago, he's stepped up the fight between government forces and what he calls bandits in that part of the country. Just last night, another firefight between the sides meant that the airport was closed to all flights going to the east of the country. The irony is that these mostly Somali refugees came to Kenya fleeing war in their own country, only to find themselves in the midst of another conflict. Bandits use the refugees as cover, moving in and around them and laying improvised explosive devices targeting security forces. So not only do the refugees have to deal with harsh camp conditions and now a conflict, but there's also crippling drought and famine. And each day, more and more refugees arrive from Somalia. These so-called climate refugees did not leave when there was conflict.
but they're now leaving and pushing the World Food Program to beyond its capacity. It's struggling to feed everyone and can't always access the camps via road because its convoys are attacked by bandits who themselves need food.
Georgina, thank you so much for joining us. What is the situation like at the moment, specifically with regards to the refugee camps in Kenya when it comes to food distribution?
Look, thanks very much for your interest. There's a really challenging situation with drought right across the Horn of Africa. If we just start with the regional situation, at the moment there are 22 million people across the Horn of Africa who are struggling to find enough to eat, including 4.4 million people here in Kenya. Bad as it is in Kenya, and we have more than a million women and children under five who are severely malnourished and in need of treatment, it is even worse somewhere else. And so what we have seen is increasing numbers of people traveling across the border from Ethiopia, across the border from Somalia, and arriving in the refugee camps, driven by a mixture of climate and conflict, drought and conflict. We've seen more than 100,000 people reach the Dadaab refugee camp in the east of the country, near the Somali border, and rising numbers in the other main camp in the country, in Kakuma.
The refugees who were refugees even before this food crisis began, specifically that group of people, how have they been affected?
There have been around 500,000 people in Kenya for quite a long period of time, displaced by earlier conflicts, either coming across the border from places like Sudan and South Sudan, or from Somalia, or even Ethiopia. Some of those people have been living in these encampments for so long that they have families of their own. And it's been my privilege to meet with some of them and to understand what it was that drove them from their homes. In most cases, it was conflict and or a lack of access to food and water and the ability to simply raise your families in peace, which is something that all of us ultimately hope to be able to achieve. Even prior to the drought, the situation for refugees in Kenya was quite dire. Refugees in Kenya last experienced a full food ration in 2018, and depending on the availability of international food assistance funded by governments around the world, then the ration has been as low as 50% through parts of 2021. It's incredibly difficult a choice to make, working in partnership with governments and the international community to make those decisions. But we recognise that it is a challenging time for the whole world. And I would like to particularly recognise all of those international donors, international governments who have continued to step up and who continue to deliver. Last year, all of the top five donors to the World Food Programme in Kenya increased their support in this region, notwithstanding significant challenges that they may have also been addressing outside of this region.
Western countries cannot hide from their involvement in the refugee crisis. The war in Somalia was triggered by Western involvement that led to the influx of Somali refugees coming here to Kenya.
And that was back in 1992, when the US started a humanitarian peacekeeping mission in Somalia. But what started as famine relief ended in war, as Somalis do not appreciate Americans running military operations in their country. Like then, again now, there are dwindling resources from the West to help refugees from a conflict they started, which then spiraled out of control and led to mass migration. And now again, history is repeating itself.
The most recent refugee crisis has again been triggered by the West. This time, they've chosen the tiny African country of Rwanda as a destination for thousands of refugees seeking shelter, this time from Europe, most notably Ukraine. What this means is that European countries like Denmark and Britain are effectively offshoring refugees and sending them thousands of miles away as human cargo, so as not to have to deal with the problem on a day-by-day basis. We now travel to Rwanda to see what preparations are being made for these refugees.
Preparations for the camps are underway, and although deportations were scheduled for April last year, then June, they have since been backtracked due to logistical issues and opposing court battles. It started with the then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announcing plans to deport illegal Ukrainian refugees to Rwanda. As an incentive, he pledged £120 million to the Rwandese President Paul Kagame. It was presented as once again Europe coming to the aid of the world, but it left many unanswered questions. Why Rwanda? And why in Africa?
Even Ukrainians themselves are not happy,
as not only is Rwanda miles away, there's also a language and cultural barrier. The British public itself has pointed out that its government has accepted white Ukrainians and even pleaded with locals to accommodate them, while brown ones are the ones likely to be deported. So much for claiming there is no institutional racism in the system. The move has gone through a court battle, which the UK won. Meanwhile, the Rwandan president continues to chase away refugees from neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, where a conflict between the government and M23 rebels is underway.
We cannot keep being host to refugees for which we are later on held accountable in some way or even abused about. Refugees as a result of ethnic cleansing based in another country. And we must be a dumping ground of these people who are being deprived of their rights.
But surprisingly, while Kagame claims his country has no capacity to house neighboring populations, he has accepted the request for Ukrainian refugees. Rwanda now faces the same fate as the camps in Kenya, with refugees being sent from the West. Will Rwanda be able to cope with the escalation cost and upkeep of refugees caused by another Western conflict?
People, innocent people, are dying every day. Even whole world are seeing on different television, different radios, are listening news, but they didn't even take a step to look for the solution. I can tell the world to hear my voice, to try their best to stop these killings of every day of innocent people. I can say in my community where I'm Mlenge, we are farmers. MONUSCO is there, United Nations are there. But our neighbors are come killing, stealing our cattle. Government are not even protect us. I can tell the world to hear my voice, to save Mlenge. Mlenge, we are people created like other people. We are God's creature. But we are dying like animals. We are voiceless. I can tell the world to hear my voice and to look at the solution of my community. Banyamulenga are dying. I saw kids. They die. Women. They kill women, raping and cutting their breasts.
The increase of refugees and the decrease of budget by the United Nations means that this problem will only get worse. Couple that with climate change and also the increasing number of conflicts in Africa, and it's clear why many people here feel desolate and disillusioned.
Behind me you can see the Kanyaruchinya refugee camp, where you can see displaced people just behind me. We have more than 100,000 Congolese people who are still fleeing from the M23 crisis. And also we have more than people who don't have access to the food. They don't have access also to the humanitarian assistance. So they are still need food. And also, according to the testimonies from different people who were living around in, especially in Nyiragongo territory and also in different areas around where there is the clash between the M23 and the Congolese army, the FRDC, there is still a very serious situation.
While in Zimbabwe, Washington's policy of imposing crippling sanctions on the Mugabe government for 25 years basically left that country in financial ruin.
By stating that the protracted demonization of Zimbabwe is mainly from bitter Western states as a result of ZANLA's ZIPRA guerrilla military brilliance, which crumbled the much-flaunted British imperialist army to its knees. Of course, that was because we had Russia and China as our key allies in dismantling the Rhodesian army, which was a proxy to the imperialist British army. This triumphant historical attribute of nationalist sovereign is what has attracted a sustained attack on Zimbabwe. And again, Zimbabwe is deemed an enemy because of the land reform program, whose dividends have notably revived our Zimbabwean economy to the shame of countries who impose sanctions on us.
It also created an immigration exodus that saw some 4 million people move across the border into South Africa as refugees. It's from South Africa that we bring you this next report.
Do sanctions actually work, or are they just the source of economic hardship and displacement? We came here to Windsor, one of the multicultural hotspots in Johannesburg, to speak to communities of Zimbabweans, to ask them about whether the sanctions of the last 20 years or so have actually had a positive impact.
Luthando, you are part of a movement that's anti-sanctions, particularly in Zim. Tell me what spurred this on and what are you hoping you'll achieve?
Well, one of the things that we realized is that sanctions were taking a huge toll on Zimbabwe. They were killing the economy. And by so doing, they were destroying jobs, destroying factories, destroying industry, and in the process, destabilizing Zimbabwe and displacing Zimbabweans into neighboring countries in SADC. So one of the things that we wanted to do was to create unity for Zimbabweans, give awareness to Zimbabweans as to what is destroying the economy, to displace people, and then to try and unite Zimbabweans to try and see how we can fight the scourge that is making people come into South Africa.
You look at a neighborhood like this, I mean, it's full of displaced people, predominantly Zimbabweans. Is this the reason why they're here? Because some might say, is the government's fault that they're here because they can't make the economy work, that they're here because of human rights abuses?
Yeah, because the thing is, sanctions are tailored to be hidden weapons. They're supposed to destroy an economy, and after destroying the economy, they're supposed to make people be divided in their own country, hate their government, so that they can remove the government. So there's been a lot of propaganda put by the Americans, the Europeans, and the United Kingdom to decampaign the Zimbabwean government, to give the impression that they're the ones that are causing people to be refugees. And then what also began to happen is that in South Africa itself, in their effort to try and control refugees from coming to the country, they need reasons to give you a refugee status. Mm. And part of the reason that they accept is they accept a story that says that Zimbabweans can't go back home, and they can't go back home because they're being persecuted, and only then can you get a refugee status. And that's why people have had to lie. But the reason that Zimbabweans are being displaced and why they're coming here to look for asylum is because they're being displaced by persecution in Zimbabwe.
So what you're saying is that even the South African government didn't appreciate the cause of this inflow of people that they've seen to South Africa. So diplomatically, do they understand how to defend Zimbabwe as a fellow SADC state, as a neighboring African country?
Now, because sanctions are a very sophisticated weapon, even the South African government did not fully appreciate what it is that was going on. First of all, they didn't appreciate that the sanctions that were on Zimbabwe were illegal, and they were a violation of human rights, and that they were destabilizing the country and killing the economy to displace refugees into South Africa.
Clearly, you're going to need, you know, a voice that's helping Zimbabwe, if you will, come together. It cannot be solved by Zimbabweans alone or its neighbors alone. So what kind of solidarity do you see within Zimbabwe and outside of Zimbabwe through neighboring countries? Do you feel like Zimbabwe needs in order to finally get this noose around its neck?
First of all, one of the reasons why we were created is that we can't expect SADC countries and other countries to understand the plight of Zimbabweans when Zimbabweans don't understand their own plight. Mm. We can't expect other countries to unite with us, can't expect there not to be xenophobia against Zimbabweans when we, the Zimbabwean people, have been divided by these sanctions. So that is why one of the very first thing that we did, and that you can see the logo here, we've got people holding hands. Mm. Zimbabweans have to come together. Zimbabweans have to begin to understand their problem, and they've got to have solidarity for themselves. Sometimes Africans seem to even understand Zimbabwe's plight better than Zimbabweans, and that itself is now beginning to galvanize Zimbabweans to start tackling this elephant in the room of sanctions and the propaganda that comes with it that has been dividing the Zimbabwean people to hate each other instead of hating the sanction senders who are actually breaking international law and human rights.
A refugee is not only a number. As a refugee father in Congo once told me, my biggest dream is that my daughters go to sleep at night not on an empty stomach. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. You can always reach out to us on one of our social media platforms. We look forward to being with you again next week. Until then, from us and the team here in Nairobi, Kwaheri. Goodbye.